Global Connections Television is a privately funded, independently produced program. The opinions expressed on Global Connections are solely those of the moderator and his guests. We invite you to go to the website at www.globalconnectionstelevision.com to view previous shows. If you are involved with a PBS or community access television station or an educational institution that has an intra-campus television hookup or perhaps a podcast or just a computer and would like to share the programs, please feel free to do so. Global Connections is provided at no cost to help people in the U.S. and worldwide better understand how international issues impact our lives.
Welcome to today's Global Connections program. I'm Bill Miller. Today, we're going to be talking about a variety of topics ranging from climate change to the Russian-Ukrainian war that's taking place in Ukraine. Our guest is an expert on these topics. Mr. John Pfeffer is the author of Splinterlands, and he is currently the director of foreign policy and focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. John Pfeffer, welcome to today's Global Connections program.
Thank you very much, Bill, for having me back on the show.
I appreciate you being with me. We could have you probably every other week with all the things that are going on in the world. But before we get into the hot button issues, talk a little bit about the Institute for Policy Studies. What exactly is the purpose of it?
Sure. So Institute for Policy Studies is a think tank in Washington, D.C., and we were set up in 1963 as a way of connecting social movements to policymakers in Washington, D.C. And so we've worked on a variety of issues over the years, from the anti-war movement in the 1960s and 70s to the civil rights movement, women's movement, more recently, Black Lives Matter movement, and so many of the social movements that have changed our life here in the United States for the better.
Wonderful. We need it. We need it desperately. And our viewers can go to your website at www.ips-dc.org. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, very good. Well, let's talk. We've jumbled our schedule a little bit here. You just mentioned that you were just returning from Europe. You were at a conference at the London School of Economics, I believe you mentioned, on the Ukrainian-Russian situation. What were some of the major conclusions that came out of that? And hopefully they have a blueprint for peace, because that poor war-torn area certainly needs it as soon as possible.
Yes. Well, I think, the two major issues were the war itself and frankly, the participants, many of whom came from Ukraine itself, were primarily focused on really how to expel Russian soldiers as quickly as possible. As your listeners, viewers know, Russia invaded Ukraine really for the second time in February of last year, after having already sent troops to the Donbas region, the Donetsk and Luhansk provinces in 2014, as well as seizing the Crimean Peninsula again in 2014. So from the Ukrainian perspective, the imperative is to get enough support, both military and economic, to push back the Russian invaders. The second kind of priority issue is economic reconstruction. And now ordinarily economic reconstruction comes after a war is over. But as I'm sure many of you know, the war has been primarily concentrated in certain parts of Eastern Ukraine. And Western Ukraine, although it is still subject to aerial bombardment by Russian forces, there is still an effort ongoing right now to reconstruct that economy, to get many of the industries and the agriculture back on track so that Ukraine can function as a real country. But then, of course, considering what kind of assistance is necessary once the war is over. And the estimates run as high as $1 trillion. I mean, there's been an enormous amount of damage. So that was kind of, those were the themes of the gathering in London.
Were any of the people at that conference, were they optimistic that maybe somewhere down the road, hopefully soon, that we could work out some type of arrangement between Ukraine and Russia to stop the war, or at least to tone it down a bit from where it is right now?
Well, to be honest, both the Ukrainian and the Russian anti-war activists were rather pessimistic about at least the Russian side agreeing to any kind of compromise at this point. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has been pretty clear that he continues to adhere to a kind of maximalist strategy, and that maximalist strategy is to really gain as much territory as possible. And still, I think the Russian government aspires to kind of topple the current Ukrainian government. But there's also a concern that even if there were a peace agreement, let's say a ceasefire that took place right now, that Russia, or at least the Russia of Vladimir Putin, would still harbor this desire to seize territory. In other words, any kind of ceasefire would only be a temporary ceasefire while Russia kind of tried to regain its strength. Now, on the optimistic side of things, Russia is having difficulty prosecuting this war. I mean, it has lost a tremendous number of soldiers. It's lost as much as one third or one half of all of its tanks. It is running out of the kinds of missiles and drones it's been using to launch its aerial attacks on Ukrainian cities. So from that point of view, it is possible that a second counteroffensive by the Ukrainian government sometime in the spring could in fact be successful, if not in pushing all of Russian forces out of Ukraine, then at least achieving a more narrower objective, which would be to basically drive a wedge between the Donbass region, which is on the eastern part of Ukraine, bordering Russia, and the Crimean Peninsula. And the Crimean Peninsula is connected to the Russian mainland only through a rather vulnerable bridge that the Putin administration built a couple years ago. And this territory that Russia seized around Mariupol, the city that it bombed rather extensively, these two provinces that constitute the kind of southern coast between the Crimean Peninsula and the Donbass region. So I think Ukraine is kind of focused on seizing or reclaiming some of that territory and separating Crimea from the Donbass, making it rather difficult for the Russians to both supply Crimea with the general everyday supplies it needs, water, food, as well as military cooperation between the two regions.
And of course, there have been so many groups involved in trying to help the Ukrainians and some helping the Russians too, I'm sure. But one that comes to mind is the United Nations and the UN. I know right now the Secretary General of the UN, Guterres, is they're pushing again the continuation, I guess you could say, of the Black Sea Grain Initiative that will allow the grains and the agricultural exports to come out of Ukraine, because they are the breadbasket for not only a large part of Europe, but also the United States and Africa. But you also have UN agencies on the ground. They've got the World Health Organization that's over there, the UN Children's Fund. You've got the International Atomic Energy Agency, a UN agency that's trying to keep those two nuclear reactors from imploding or exploding or being destroyed. You've got a full complement of United Nations agencies on the ground. And in New York, you've got a semi-paralyzed UN Security Council because Russia has a veto. And anything that Russia doesn't like, as being one of the five permanent members of the UN, they can veto that. So it's almost, I don't want to say a schizophrenic situation, but it's certainly challenging for the Secretary General of the United Nations and the United Nations as a whole. But I guess we better move on before we run out of time here. That topic could tie us up for quite a while. But one other two, I got one of your publications recently. And shifting gears here, if we talk about climate change, I still believe that that's still our major number one problem on this planet. We're making progress in some areas, but we're losing ground in others. I just saw a report that the last 8 years have been the hottest on record. We're going up, up, up. We're not breaking. We're not going down. But you put in one of your articles that there was a huge chunk of ice the size of London that just broke off of Antarctica. And the Hinman Glacier, I guess, outside of Seattle has disappeared. This is happening all around the world. What can we do? We see the problem. A lot of people, we know why the fossil fuels, the Exxon Mobils, the Chevrons, all these folks are trying to keep fossil fuels out there because they want to sell this stuff. But we know that that's destroying, to a large degree, our planet because of the huge carbon footprint. What can we do to move more quickly to clean energy? And what's going to happen if we don't?
Well, let me make a bridge to the previous topic, which, of course, was the war in Ukraine. Unfortunately, that war has marked a real step backward in terms of addressing climate change, in part because Russian exports have declined to Europe, and therefore a number of, and around the world, a number of countries have kind of fallen back on their pledges to cut back on fossil fuel use, and they've actually ramped up fossil fuel use, including here in the United States. And many of your viewers will be well aware that the Biden administration just released a contract for drilling, offshore drilling in Alaska, something which was previously thought he would never do that, given the administration's commitment to, or at least rhetorical commitment to, clean energy. And Russia itself has backtracked on its pledges to cut back on its fossil fuel use and its carbon footprint. So the war really has been a step backward. I think in terms of moving forward, well, I mean, one thing we have to do is really reduce the $1 trillion annual subsidies that are provided to fossil fuel companies. I mean, this is extraordinary that these companies are making, well, to be honest, in the last year, record profits, Chevron, Exxon, record profits because of, again, as I said, the renewed kind of demand for fossil fuels. And yet they're also receiving these subsidies as well for either drilling or for processing or for selling and transport. So that has to be eliminated. But I think if we get down to the more core issue, well, honestly, Bill, I mean, we, all of us, are simply using too much energy. I mean, we can talk about shifting over to solar and wind, but the bottom line is that as long as our consumption of energy continues to rise, there's no way we're going to be able to shift over in any kind of effective or a quick enough way to renewable sources to really reduce our carbon footprints. To do so, we have to reduce our demand. We have to reduce, frankly, our economic growth. And when I say our economic growth, what I'm talking about are the advanced countries. Of course, there are plenty of poorer countries in the world that are still holding, having been held back for generations, want to move forward, want to be able to grow economically, and they should have that opportunity. But for them to do so, we in the industrialized world really have to cut back on our consumption across the board. And so not just energy, but the products that are manufactured with energy. And that is, that's an urgent task for us today.
It certainly is. Now, you wrote the, I guess it was a novel of called Splinterlands a few years ago, and you describe a world where the superpowers have fractured, global temperatures have soared, the global economy has collapsed, and violent nationalism prevailed. Do you see some of that happening right now? We see some semi-violent nationalism in the United States and some other areas of the world, and we're also seeing a collapse of some of these systems. Do you see it actually coming to fruition? I'm not trying to predict that it's going to happen. You know, it could or it couldn't, but do you see that underway right now?
Well, unfortunately, I do. I mean, I published a book in 2016, and that was just around the time of the election of Donald Trump. And not just because of his election, but the election of many politicians similar in their perspective to Donald Trump. In other words, very suspicious of global institutions, of globalists, of international community, of the United Nations. And because of that kind of overall public trust in global institutions has eroded over the years. And some of those institutions, frankly, just are no longer effective. I mean, you referred to, of course, the Security Council, which is paralyzed at the moment because of Russia's involvement in the Security Council, its invasion of Ukraine, and its wielding of its veto option. But it's not the only institution. I mean, if we look at, for instance, the Paris Agreement on climate change, again, to bridge over from the previous question, all of the commitments under the Paris Agreement are voluntary. That means there's no obligation by any country to meet its goals of cutting carbon emissions, and there are no authorities, global authorities, that can punish countries that are not in compliance with their own pledges. That's deeply problematic. That suggests that, you know, that when we talk about an international community, we're really talking mostly about a rhetorical international community, one that doesn't have the necessary mechanisms to enforce collective agreements and collective decisions. We will see that as well with war crimes. I mean, Russia has stands accused of thousands of war crimes throughout Ukraine, bombing of civilians, killing of unarmed soldiers, etc. But the international authorities for addressing war crimes, I'm afraid they are not at the moment effective in terms of going after the Russian government or Vladimir Putin or the people responsible for those war crimes. So at the moment, the kind of nervous system, the skeletal system of the international community is very weak indeed. And unless we see a new generation of politicians, and we have seen some, I mean, obviously, Gustavo Petro, Gabriel Boric in Chile, Petro in Colombia, some new kind of new thinking among politicians. But unless that becomes a much bigger trend, I think the international community, unfortunately, is on life support.
It is to a large degree. And of course, now the United Nations is really the organizational structure that brings all these countries together. But it's up to those countries to actually fulfill their word and to carry out what they say they're going to do. And if they don't, there's no mechanism to hold them accountable. Unfortunately, the UN cannot do that, and it won't happen because it's a voluntary type of situation. The UN's not a one world government. It doesn't have the authority to do it. Well, you're watching Global Connections Television, which is a privately funded, independently produced program. The opinions expressed on Global Connections are solely those of the moderator and his guest. We'd invite our viewers to go to our website at www.globalconnectionstelevision.com to view previous shows. If you are involved with a PBS or community access television station, or perhaps an educational institution that has an intra-campus television hookup, or you have a podcast, or you just have a computer and you like our shows and you would like to share them, please feel free to do so. Global Connections Television is provided at no cost as a public service to help us better understand international issues and how they impact our lives. Today, we're talking about a wide range of issues from Ukraine to the United Nations to war and peace and a variety of others. My guest is an expert on these topics. Mr. John Pfeffer is the author of Splinterlands, and he is currently director of foreign policy and focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. John, you were talking here, you mentioned we sort of made the transition to get into other areas and talked about, we talked about when Donald Trump was elected and several things that he did, it's come to fruition, has made the world much more dangerous, made the situation much worse. One that comes to mind is the Iranian nuclear deal. He got us out of that, even though his people, the Trump administration, tried to talk him into staying into it. He finally got us out saying he was going to crack a better deal. Never happened, wasn't going to happen. And now we're sitting on the brink where the Iranians could go nuclear. You mentioned the Paris Agreement that we've had that he has withdrawn us from and a variety of others. So as you look at these topics, where are we now and what can the Biden administration do to repair the damage done and to get us back on track? Because these are very meaningful agreements, especially the Iranian, well, all of them are really, but the Iranian nuclear deal, and the Iranians were actually abiding by the agreement. And now they say, well, you broke the agreement, we're out. So what can be done to get us back on track, either by the Biden administration, by the United Nations, by our allies, or anybody else who can help contribute to sweeping up some of the damage that has been done?
Yeah, well, that's a tough question. The Biden administration came in to office and almost immediately said, look, we're back. We're back in the international community. We will kind of fulfill our obligations under the Paris Agreement, for instance. We will try to renegotiate the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, as quickly as possible. We are going to, you know, work hard on new arms control agreements with Russia, if that's possible, et cetera, et cetera. And to a certain extent, we have seen a much more engaged U.S. administration than anything, of course, we saw under Trump. At the same time, the Biden administration has kept in place certain elements of the Trump administration policy. Now, as I said, it has in good faith tried to negotiate with the Iranians, although it might have been able to do a better job early on if it had made some concessions to the Iranians. As you said, the Iranians had kept to the agreement, and the Biden administration was kind of stonewalling them on that. But nevertheless, they were at least authentically interested in getting that agreement back. But on other issues, for instance, on China, Trump administration famously imposed economic sanctions on China, as well as tariffs. And the Biden administration has kept some of those in place and has, in my mind, missed some opportunities to come to some modus operandi with the Chinese on areas of mutual concern. I mean, there's no question that the United States and China are going to disagree about a lot of things, but there are some things they're going to agree on. And one of those is climate change. And we have John Kerry, of course, serving as kind of special envoy on climate issues with China, trying to get that agenda back back in force. But it's been tough. I would like to see the Biden administration work a little harder on that, maybe dangle some incentives in front of China to get them to come back to the table on these issues. Immigration is another area where the Biden administration promised that it would kind of repeal all of the worst aspects of the Trump administration policy. And of course, we're not seeing a wall. Yes, the Biden administration said no more wall separating the United States and Mexico, but it has kept in place some elements of the Trump administration policy. For instance, the transit ban, which is a way of forcing asylum seekers to apply for asylum in the countries that they pass through on their way from their home country to the United States, which is actually a pretty steep bar that they have to get over in order to achieve asylum in the United States. And that really is not in compliance with international law on asylum seeking. So that those are problems with, I think, the Biden administration and its approach. And of course, going back to the initial question, which was on Ukraine, you know, the Biden administration has poured a lot of money into supporting Ukraine. And from my point of view, that's justifiable. It's money well spent. We're talking about over $100 billion, over $30 billion in military aid, and then the rest in non-military assistance. And that's just in the last year. If you look at what, for instance, the administration's budget for Latin America is, it's about $2.4 billion a year. $2.4 billion for the entire Latin America versus over $100 billion for Ukraine. Now, of course, Ukraine is in a war. It's fighting for its very survival. It's understandable. It gets more money. But you can understand also why Latin Americans might say, hey, how come we don't get anything near that? I mean, as a region, we're not even getting, you know, what you supply to Israel, military assistance, or Egypt, or military assistance. So there's good reason for other parts of the world, Latin America, Africa, Asia, to be understandably upset about Biden administration policy, feeling that, yeah, okay, the administration has said, we're back in the international community, but that the definition of international community for the Biden administration is pretty narrow, that it means Europe, it means countries in the global north, and not very much money or attention or even sympathy for the plight of folks living south of the equator is unfortunately reality for the Biden administration right now.
Exactly. John Pfeffer, you hit it on the head. I think we're going to have to reorient our priorities, and throwing into that mix, we're going to have to look at this massive bloated defense budget that we have, because that is taking up a large part of our financial resources. But that will, I'm afraid we'll have to hold that for another program. John Pfeffer, I want to thank you so very much for a very interesting and a very informative program.
It's been a pleasure to be back on the show, and I look forward to future conversations.
Thank you. My pleasure. I'm Bill Miller. Thank you for joining us today on Global Connections Television.